The young seminary student was about to go to his first church, where he would be expected to deliver a sermon every Sunday. And not having done this, he was very anxious about the prospect. So he went to the professor and asked, "What should I preach about?" "Two things," came the answer. "Preach about God and preach about 20 minutes. From medieval France, the story is that at the end of the Mass, the priest said, "And now I'd like to say a few words about God." And one peasant in the congregation said, "The fewer the better." He was arrested for mouthing off like that. The fundamental question about God, of course, is whether such a being exists. Is there a God? To answer that question, I borrow from the formulation made notorious by a former U.S. president. It depends on what you mean by is. If by is you mean that God exists in something like the way a tree or a bee or a planet exists, that is, independent of human thought or creation, I would say that the answer is no, God does not exist in that way. But if you ask whether God is real, then I suggest at least the possibility of another, different answer. Something may be real but not exist. The future, for instance, is very real for us, but it does not exist. So to answer the question, is there a God, one must also say that it depends on what you mean by God. And let me say now that the analysis I'm about to present would apply regardless of the gender and number of God. Historically, most people have focused their religious yearnings on a god or a goddess or a number of gods and goddesses. The key point about God or goddess in every religious tradition is that he or she is conceived as a person. Indeed, any adequate definition of God must include this personal character, because that is what makes God so important to us humans who are also persons. Now, by person, I do not mean human. We humans are persons, but the concept of personal is broader than human and applies at least potentially to other things than humans. I define a person as any being that thinks, feels, and wills, that is, which chooses, makes decisions, acts on the basis of those choices rather than from necessity. Thus, for example, a rock or a tree is not a person. Animals are probably not persons, though some of you would argue with that, because we tend to attribute personal character to our pets, which really do seem sometimes to think, feel, and will. One of the ways we demonstrate that personal attribution to at least some animals is that we give them personal names. Persons have names. When we give a personal name to something, we are in effect saying that that thing is in some way a person to us. Similarly, a god or goddess is a personal being, one which thinks, feels, and acts. And as I have mentioned, the great appeal and value of this is that it makes it possible for us persons to relate in a personal, even intimate way to a supreme person. Most people have found it unsatisfying to think of the ultimate and perfect power of the universe as some kind of impersonal being or force, though the Star Wars movies made popular the possibility of the force. but especially in times of grief and loss. It has been very comforting to most people to hear that God loves and cares for us and has some reason for some terrible thing that has happened. For like us, God is a person, a being who thinks, feels, and thus can sympathize with our feelings and wills. It is rather like the small child who gets hurt and cries because he or she thinks the whole world has come to an end, but is consoled in a few minutes when the parent, who of course represents for the child the greatest and most secure power in the universe, hugs the child and says, "There, there, everything is all right." That's what God does for people when they need it. And that's why the most enduring images for God are father and or mother. But now here's the irony. That is also why some of us are suspicious of the personal God idea as a literal representation of the ultimate reality. Because you see, an all-powerful God who loves us and cares for us is just what we would like there to be. And presuming that what we would like to be the case actually is the case may be emotionally gratifying, but not necessarily intellectually satisfying. And that in turn means that for those of us who demand intellectual cogency in everything, including, I would say, especially our religion, the very notion of a personal God is problematic at best, perhaps even a stumbling block. A personal God has become questionable because of what our intellects have discovered during the past 3 or 4 centuries to be the facts about the world in which we live. Thus, we know that the sun does not rise each morning because God tells it to, but because of clearly known gravitational laws which govern the relations of all the bodies in the universe. Lightning does not strike because an angry God is hurling thunderbolts, but because meteorological conditions produce such natural phenomena. Human beings were not created because of the conscious act of God in some particular point in time, but rather we evolved and are still evolving over a period of millions of years, which has seen an amazing but comprehensible development from the simplest one-celled organism to the enormously complex and interesting life form which we humans are. Our universe itself was not created by God, certainly not like the first chapters of Genesis suggest, but rather was incited by a Big Bang some 13.7 billion years ago, and that Big Bang must have been preceded by something, though that is not totally accurate, because the Big Bang created not only space, but time. But that is an idea which those of us who are not Einstein find very difficult to understand. In any case, something like the universe, in wildly different, presently unimaginable forms, has always existed. And all of this means that intellectually, you don't need God anymore to explain how and why things are the way they are. However, I want to suggest, though most Americans would probably disagree, that doing away with God does not necessarily mean doing away with religion. Religion, in its root meaning, is the attempt to connect with that reality that is beyond and infinitely greater than the reality of our own puny selves. It means discovering that we are not alone in the universe, but are a vital part of the universe. It means that precisely since we are a vital part of the universe, our lives and the lives of everything and everyone else as well have value and purpose, whether or not we always recognize that purpose. A personal God is only one way to conceive of the infinitely greater reality. So let God go. There, I have said it and have not yet at least been stricken dead. So much for destruction. Now to make an attempt at construction. If not God, what? Here I'm afraid I have to become rather heavily philosophical, even more than already. Not because that is the best way, but because it is the way I tend to think. And for better or worse, since I'm the one doing the sermon today, you're stuck with it. Begin with this basic perception. Nothing can come from nothing. That is, if literally nothing existed, then nothing ever could or would exist. But manifestly, something does exist. And that necessarily implies that something must have always and eternally existed. Not, of course, in its present form, but in some way there has always been some sort of existence or being. Now the question is, what is that which has always existed? Traditional philosophy and theology have called it God. But as we have seen, some of us have trouble with that concept. So what else can we call it? Strictly speaking, we cannot and should not call it anything, because to give something a name is to differentiate it from everything else. By calling an object a book, I am saying that it is not a pencil or a building or a planet or anything else in the universe. So with all the other names or words of things. But this thing we are trying to name cannot be differentiated from everything else, because at the deepest level it is everything. To give it a name would imply that there is something that it is not. But since it is everything, there is nothing that it is not. Do I see some eyes glazing over? I'll say that sentence again. To give it a name would imply that there is something it is not. But since it is everything, there is nothing that it is not. So we cannot really call it anything. And if we have no word for it, we cannot talk about it. Perhaps not even think about it. But we humans are inveterate talkers and thinkers. So we just have to call it something. What will do the trick? The 20th century theologian Paul Tillich used to call what we're trying to talk about the ground of all being, though that is probably too abstract for most of us. For another possibility, I go back 2,500 years to a Chinese source, which is a useful reminder that we modern Americans are not the first to have tried to deal with this problem. An ancient legendary figure called Laozi said, in effect, "There is something which has always been, and you cannot really speak of it. But if you really must talk about it, and since you are humans, you probably must, just call it Tao," a common Chinese word meaning simply way or path. What really is just a way. Much of the appeal of this suggestion is the dynamism of the concept. A way is moving, never static. It is relative, never absolute. It is flexible and open, never rigid or closed. It is natural, never artificial. How can you know this Tao, this way? You can know it, said those ancient Chinese sages, by just looking. Especially by looking and truly seeing how the way is exhibited in the world of nature. What you can discover in nature is that things happen just because they happen. It is the way of a tree to grow and produce leaves and fruit. It is the way of a shark to eat smaller fish. It is the way of clouds to drop rain and snow. It is the way of a river to run into the sea. No one has to do anything for those things to happen. There is no intention in nature, no self-consciousness. Rather, things proceed spontaneously. They just happen, all according to their way, their Tao. The Taoist mystics also said that you can discover that immortal way in the deepest levels of your own being. In those precious moments when you have a feeling of being one, truly connected with everything that is. And to experience such moments, they said, you have to stop being artificial. You have to stop forcing things to happen. Just go with the flow, a very Taoist bit of advice. And you may realize, that is, make real to yourself, that ultimate and eternal being which lies at the root of all the things we normally perceive and which may best be compared to a way. If nothing else, the Taoist message reminds us that all, absolutely all religious language is metaphorical, not literal. As some of us see it, where Western religious thought got off the track was when people began to presume from the God metaphor or symbol that there really is such a being. But to get back to the Tao, what difference does it make? What if we take seriously and find meaning in this image of the way? What will change? Well, say the sages, your whole way of looking at things will change, and with that, everything will change for you. You will see and know, for example, that everything is relative. At least for us humans, there are no absolutes in life. And when we think there are, we are at our most dangerous. But the ancient Taoist teachers were not nearly as abstract as I have been this morning, so you'll be greatly relieved as I borrow from them a couple illuminating stories to illustrate this point about relativity. The first is called Three in the Morning. It seems that hard times had come, so the keeper of the monkeys was forced to reduce their rations. From now on, he said, you will receive 3 bananas in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. The monkeys howled in rebellion, and after long and hard-fought negotiations, the keeper finally relented and agreed that instead of getting 3 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, they could have 4 bananas in the morning and 3 in the afternoon. The monkeys were delighted with their triumph. You know who the monkeys are, don't you? The other story helps us to understand that not even good and evil are absolutes. They are relative to each other in the Taoist perspective. It is about the farmer whose horse ran away. When the poor farmer's horse ran away, his neighbor came to commiserate about what a terrible thing had happened to him. But the farmer said, who knows what's good or bad? And the next day, lo and behold, his horse returned, bringing with it a whole herd of horses. So this time the farmer congratulated him on his good fortune. He now had dozens of horses. But again said the farmer, who knows what's good or bad? And it was so, because the next day his son tried to ride one of the new horses and was thrown off, breaking his leg in the process. Neighbor, oh, what bad luck! Farmer, well, who knows what is good or bad? And yet again it was so, for the next day, soldiers came around looking for young recruits for their army, but passed up the farmer's son because of his broken leg. To see things from the perspective of the Tao, the eternal way, is to realize that our own individual perspectives and consequent judgments are limited and incomplete. To know the Tao is to have a wider view, which makes us not only more alive, but more appreciative of that part of life which has been entrusted to us. I know that I'm getting close to the end of my promised 20 minutes, and I will keep that part of the bargain, even if what I have said about God is probably not what the seminary professor had in mind. But I hope I have suggested that if you find the traditional God ideas confining or inadequate, you can still discover other and more positive ways to understand and express your religiousness. I close with two very brief insights. If there is not God, is there in fact something more? Some greater reality than we can conceive. Well, on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I'm pretty sure there is. But on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, I'm rather more skeptical. And on Sunday, I go to church. Am I then an agnostic? Not exactly. An agnostic is one who does not know. But I do know at least two things. One, whatever greater, even ultimate reality there is greater than our human minds can adequately comprehend, which means that all of our attempts are provisional, subject to improvement. Two, the second thing I know, without any doubt whatsoever, is that I could be wrong. Now, if this were a Baptist church, you would all rise and exclaim, Amen, brother!